What's up? This is Movies On Up. The blinds moving up and down, the squeaky shoes, and then the knife whistling past her ear, and then the man seated across from me whispering into his microphone.
Is that that dark movie, that old classic one? I like it. It's like the one I like.
Yes.
Is that that one?
It is.
Yeah,
it is.
I like that movie, but I forget the name of it.
Well, I'll tell you. Yeah. It is our tagline for this week. So, boys and girls, get right. It is an Audrey Hepburn movie from 1967. So, it is super old. So, Dave has actually seen movies that predate 1979.
I like that movie a lot.
Yeah, it is called Wait Until Dark.
That's it. I knew it was something dark.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's it. That dark movie. Alan Arkin's in it.
Audrey
Richard
Hepburn.
Crenna.
Yeah.
Good flick.
One of the best. Like, yeah, that movie's good.
Yes. Great movie. You should check it out, and you should also send us Wait Until Dark in one of the following ways. You can send it to us in an email, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can leave it on our Facebook page, facebook.com/moviesonup, or tweet your guess to us at moviesonup on the Twitter. If you are correct, and you should be, it's not like you got to take a shot in the dark in this one, and we choose you, you will win a Movies On Up prize package, which you'll just have to wait for your mailman to come. This week, Dr. Sleep comes out in theaters. That is a Mike Flanagan sequel to The Shining, which led us to a couple things. We could have done Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I feel like there's a lot out there that's already been said about.
I don't think I've seen it all the way through. That's the only reason I suggested it. Like, yeah. I've seen most of it. I know the gist of it, but I don't think I haven't seen. And we weren't going to do the Steven Weber Shining.
Yeah, kind of feel like that goes without saying. But I think that there's enough on this planet about the Kubrick Shining and even the Stephen King novel. Those are fairly well known in the horror genre. But being that Dr. Sleep is the sequel and it is a Mike Flanagan movie, you don't really have to give us an excuse to talk about Mike Flanagan. We do that a lot. But this week we certainly had that excuse, so we thought we would do a Flanagan movie. And we went back to sort of the genesis, if you will, of our love affair with Mr. Flanagan. And that was a movie from 2016, a Netflix movie called Hush. You've probably heard us talk about that before. I guarantee if you've listened to this podcast for at least a month, you've heard us talk about it as the heroine from this movie, Maddie, made our best final girl list.
Ms. Flanagan, Katie.
Yes. Something. Katie Siegel.
I don't know. I can't remember.
The other half of Mike Flanagan. As they are married, she stars opposite John Gallagher and a brief appearance from Michael Trucco. Being a Netflix movie, there is not really a box office to speak of because it's Netflix. They don't release any data to indicate how many folks watched it. The two folks in this room watched it and liked it a lot. So we thought we would see if we can at least double the amount of people that have seen Hush. Double it to 4. But I do have some box office numbers on some of the other movies that Flanagan was making at that time. Oculus, 2 years before, in April of 2014, opened to $12 million on its way to $27.6 million domestically. And Ouija, : Origin of Evil, opened to $14 million in October. The same year, Hush came out, earning just over $35 million. Those are both in that Blumhouse playbook.
They're studio horrors.
Yeah.
This is
low budget studio horror.
His career is fascinating because sometimes you see directors kind of settle in and find a home, like in the studio system, or, you know, they settle in at Netflix and find. He's done both.
And is still.
Like, he got Oculus. That was based on a short film that he made. For a debut horror, that was like a wide release. That was a studio horror. And then he did Hush with Netflix. Before I Wake, that was a studio horror. It got kicked around for a few years, but then went on to Origin of Evil, a prequel to Ouija, because they could make it cheap, which was better than it had any right to be. And then that leads up to Dr. Sleep, this major, major, not just studio movie. Like, there's a lot behind this. Whereas Hush led to Gerald's Game, the Stephen King adaptation, mm-hmm. which led to The Haunting of Hill House, which is one of the most beautiful TV shows ever. It's such a good show. So for him to settle into this doing cool stuff at Netflix and also making studio horror movies, it's impressive because any director out there would settle for falling into one of those systems. And for him to do both and be successful.
The budget for Oculus. And I remember seeing that. If it's a horror movie, at the time, I was just seeing it. I would go to the theaters, pre-movie pass, but I had time and disposable income, so I would just watch Oculus. And Flanagan low-key has a history now of working with characters from Battlestar. Katie Sackhoff was in that. So I thought, let me check that out. It was certainly, like you said, better than it had a right to be.
That was the year that everybody tried to make Britton Thwaites happen.
Yes, it was.
He did like five things that year.
They gave him Britton Thwaites and $5 million, and he doubled the budget in the opening. If you wonder how someone gets the opportunity to do like the sequel to The Shining, you do stuff like this. He's got that track record of making a profitable movie. But then you look at specifically Hill House, and while we have no idea how much money that made or how many people watched it on Netflix, I don't think you can really argue about what an impact that made. I mean, a lot of people were talking about that when it came out. So he's got that horror cred. He can make something that's scary, but what the studios like about that is they know he can be profitable. That's how you end up not only working in both of those areas, but with the sequel to The Shining.
The Netflix stuff that's really, really good is it's character driven. You really care about these characters. Like, I haven't had a family affect me as much as the family in Hill House. That show emotionally is one of the most emotional roller coasters I've ever been on when binging a show. It got me. The relationship between Gillian and Thwaites in Oculus, you know, he does that. Where he shines is when he gets the freedom to really let these characters develop and be who they are, which you don't really get to do in studio horror movies as much, but he tries to sneak that in. But yet in this, he gives her a lot. I mean, she wrote it with him, but right, they give her a lot to work with.
In fairness, there's not a lot of people that they have to develop, essentially, other than Maddie and the killer. And this is where we really started to notice him. It's not just a throwaway studio. Like, Oculus was a Blumhouse movie more than it was a Flanagan movie. Part of it was because his name didn't carry the weight at the time, but it just felt like it was in that system. But Hush was something completely different. Very grounded movie, a cat and mouse game that really, for a bottle movie that takes place essentially within a house or within the close proximity.
On a property.
Right.
Yeah.
He made great use of all that. It's a very simple concept. It's a woman being terrorized by a would-be killer. There's no bells and whistles. But in order for it to be the kind of excellent movie it was, that didn't have anything to do with Blumhouse. That had everything to do with him as a filmmaker. I think that's where both of us were like, oh, shit.
And not just as a filmmaker, as a writer. Like, the stuff he does to build up this movie. Sarah, the neighbor, she's in this movie 10 minutes, but you see such a good relationship between her and the neighbor. Like, how excited she gets for the neighbor to come over. Because she is in this isolated area, and you have this, could be the annoying neighbor, but she's not. She's this fun. Even in the text messages, when you read, hey, can I stop over? The previous history, she's joking the whole time. That character is built up so well. And in a movie with a very low body count, to make that first kill matter on this character that's very minimal in there, I think he does a really, really good job, because he builds that character up in little screen time. And you see how she reacts to Maddie and how they interact with each other. And you see that Maddie truly does care about her. Like, she's moved off to isolation, but at least she has a friend next door. So like, her death is hard for me. Like, I'm usually, horror movie deaths, especially the first one, are usually just throwaway, except for Deep Star 6. But like, that one's brutal. And the scene is, oh, her death scene is, it's nuts. He does a lot. And he sets up, she's deaf and mute. Oh, it was 13. So is the voice in your head a kid? No, it sounds like my mom. Craig, they broke up a year ago. It's been a year. You know a lot about her without wasting all this time. I mean, obviously she's not telling her story. Her sister, you know, set up with the picture of them real close. And then the brief conversation with them. Like, I worry about you, Squish. You learn a lot about her, and you get to know Maddie. So it's not just cat and mouse, it's Tom and Jerry. It's these characters that you know, her especially. You're inside her world. The stuff he does with the sound is different than a lot of deaf in movies, where a lot of deaf scenes will just go silent. Where he does a really good job of, like, there's that static there.
Yeah, he had thought about originally making this movie a silent movie, but then he kind of thought that people would, if you go see it in a theater, they're just going to be listening to the air conditioning or people eating popcorn, and that would kind of take you out of it, or they wouldn't see it at all. So he went to adding in, like, I think it was an ultrasound machine is one of the things that kind of creates that white noise of the movie.
Noise. It's just static. It's just, it's there. It's right. Not anything. And
he does such a great job of establishing this character so fully, so quickly. It's not very long before the killer shows up, but at that point, Maddie is this fully realized, like, we understand her handicap. We know a lot about her, and the performance that Siegel gives, not just in that
have
first
a line in the whole movie.
Well,
but I mean, like, that's impressive.
Right.
There's not a single line. She's deaf and mute that doesn't change, and she pulls it off.
But she's
so
still
well.
Able to give a great performance.
It's amazing.
Where you can see a shift in her character, and you can see, like, a strength in that character that I don't think has anything to do with her handicap.
Maddie doesn't have a line. She does have lines when she's talking to herself and the voice in her head, but still, like, she's so good as Maddie. That character doesn't have a line, but she's so good with that arc, just actions speaking louder than anything else.
The cat to Maddie's mouse. It would be kind of an uneven movie if our killer didn't bring something to it as well. And for what starts out being a masked killer, there's not much that would be asked of you. But John Gallagher was absolutely up to the task. He was menacing and almost like the personification of just needless evil, and he nailed it. He was exactly what an antagonist should be. He knows that, number one, he's preying on a woman, so he already feels like he's at an advantage. She has a handicap that he knows about, so he's exploiting that too. And he's just messing with her. He's giving her these openings.
It's a game. It's a game for him. It's literally a game. And I mean, he says that. I can get in this house anytime I want, but I'm going to wait until you wish you were dead. He basically says, like, I'm going to terrorize you. And it's all a game. There's no personal vendetta. There's no revenge. He killed the neighbor brutally. That scene's still so good with her in the background. He's just a dude that just wants to kill, which is terrifying.
That's it. So many times,
I can't remember if it was the original The Strangers or if it was Martyrs, when it's like, why us? And the answer is just, you were home. That's kind of what this is like.
I think it was The Strangers.
I think it is, because yeah. Martyrs was in what, that French?
Yeah, that was a completely different.
There's one that was like that. There was a home invasion.
Funny Games.
No,
is that what you mean?
No. That's so terrifying. Like, it's just a dude. No supernatural thing, no possession. He's just a dude that wants to kill people.
Right. Like I had mentioned, it's very grounded. And one of the things, when you're watching a horror movie, you kind of feel like you need to yell at the screen. Not that it would have worked in Maddie's case, but you hope the characters hear you and just do the obvious thing. What was so great about Hush was that it takes into account what the obvious thing would be and then manages to ratchet up the horror when that thing is done and it still doesn't work out. And nowhere is that more evident than one of the best scenes that I've seen in horror recently, when she's like, okay, this guy is absolutely out of his mind, but you know what? I haven't seen your face. You're locked out of there. I'm locked in here. I haven't seen your face. You can just bugger off. And he just peels his mask off. Right at that very moment, you're thinking, oh, well, I mean, I could see how that would work. Let's just cut our losses, no harm done. But as soon as he responds to that, that's the moment where everything in the movie changes.
Oh, yeah. Ills is the movie I was thinking of. I knew it was from that French era where there was a bunch of ills, which is translates to them. That's what I was thinking of. It's kids at the end. It's the kids getting on a bus to go to school. It was insane. Yeah, that scene is so good. And what's good is that's a very tempting scene to drag out. He doesn't. It's quick. He reads it. I haven't seen your face. And it's just instant. Just pulls it off. That's more evil. Now, all of a sudden, the non-mask killer is more evil because it's not this. I mean, it is a monster, but right. It's not.
Now there's a face to it. It's now not an idea of evil. It's this man.
Yeah. And he just pulls it off. Now you have. And that's basically just his way of saying, one of us dies tonight. Like, in his mind, it's you die tonight. And
There's no other way out of it. You know, she offers a way out. This doesn't have to end poorly for either of us. Mm. We can just let bygones and murdered neighbors be murdered neighbors. And he's just not having it. He's showing you that there's no way to talk your way out of this. You are going to die tonight because that's what I came here to do. It's and inevitability.
That, and that's where Gallagher really starts to shine. I mean, one of the really good scenes is when John shows up looking for Sarah. And he comes up with a flashlight, like acting like a cop. Just the change. This dude is determined. He could easily hide or give up. She's got help. I could just go. No, he's determined. So just that change and that shift. And he's so good in this movie. And he had this 10 Cloverfield Lane came out. And I thought, like, oh, this dude's going to be in a lot of... I haven't really seen him in anything since. But he was really good in both of those. I like how Flanagan and Siegel wrote a lot of this because I talked about, like, oh, even the text messages are character development. But then she talks about writer brain when she's asked about how'd you come up with that ending? And, oh, I have, you know, I come up with all these endings. And then even when her sister's calls, are you working on the ending? Which one? I have seven. And I like that that comes back to play later. And the way this movie is written, one of my favorite screenwriters, one of my favorite directors is Edgar Wright. There is a lot of stuff done in this movie that's very much what I like about how Edgar Wright writes, with the foreshadowing, and it's kind of telegraphed, but super subtly, and how just one line comes into play an hour later, but not like driven home. I love stuff like that, and this movie is full of stuff like that.
If you're not paying attention, for lack of a better word, the Tom Cruise resets that you get in this movie can seem out of place. But when you understand that he already told you this is how this woman's brain works, she tries to think through these scenarios to find the best outcome. And that's what she puts in her story. Anybody in that position would be faced with a multitude of options. She's just trying to logically think them out.
There's that scene where she's talking to herself as the voice. Like, it's her, but then she's physically there, like, you can't run. It'll kill you. If you hide, he'll eventually find you. There's only one way out of this. And then it's just kill him.
And by the second time that she writes on the door, after she's got her hand smashed,
I'll talk about that in a minute.
By the time she invites him in, she is a completely different character. She's written the note to her family saying that she died fighting and trying to identify him just in case it goes bad.
That's what I was going to bring up, is that scene with the computer where it's like, 5'9", green eyes, blah, blah, blah. I died fighting, love you. That's so good. That's such a good, it's such a brief scene. That's awesome.
After she sends that and writes that message on there, she's at that point really resigned to whatever fate's got in store for her. She realizes there's a good possibility she's going to die, and she's okay with it. She invites that in. She's almost antagonizing him at that point. She's done being scared, and she's just ready to face it. And I love those scenes so much, those writing on the door scenes. That's the most meaningful communication they have with each other. And both of those messages signal such a tonal shift for not only just the character, but the dynamics of their relationship.
Well, the first one, she's sitting on the step. She's away from the door, like, please read this. He's looking down to read it. And then the next one, they're face-to-face through the glass, and she writes it out. He watches her write it out, which is close to face-to-face as you can be without... It's just, it's so good.
Being right behind her, breathing on her neck.
Yeah. Yeah, and that scene, like, that's the... she knows he's stronger than her and that he's got all these advantages. He knows. And then it's his arrogance, essentially, that does it out. But the point I wanted to bring up about the hand is one thing Mike Flanagan does is his movies aren't really bloodbaths. They aren't just these schlock filled with blood, but when he wants to get gore, it gets gory. Like, the hand was gross, you know, even the arm with the hammer. And then you go to Gerald's Game.
Oh yeah. That's why you wear gloves.
Yeah. He doesn't waste it, but he doesn't overdo it either. Where I feel like something like Brightburn this year, the gore moments I feel like are almost overdone and they don't really fit in. He gets really gory, but it's realistic. As he's stomping on her hand, you can feel that. As he gets the hammer in the arm, you can feel that.
And it's very much, if you like you said, the Brightburn doesn't fit. This is very much on brand for this guy. He's torturing her. That's what this is. She was reaching, and he literally just slammed the door on her, And then
that's not enough.
Right. Yeah. Then he stomped on her hand.
Not once.
Yes. just to further assert his physical dominance. Okay. Now I was already stronger than her. She's already handicapped. And now she can't use her hand either. So you can sort of understand the arrogance that comes into play there at the end, because he has got her in his mind so utterly beaten. There is absolutely no advantage she has other than he's just, for the first time in the movie, he's really not aware of...
He gets cocky.
Yeah, the entire situation, and it pays for it.
There's a shot at the end of just them laying together, and it looks like a shot out of a love story, out of a movie to where these lovers have endured all this, because they're not really cuddling, but they're laying on the ground, and they're essentially touching, like they're right next to each other, and... It's just such a beautiful shot. And when you let him free to just play, I mean, you get stuff like this. You get the episode that's almost one single shot in Hill House. He's a really fantastic director. And I do like that. If he were just getting stuck in the studio system and just making Oculus and Dr. Sleep and Ouija, I don't really think you see that. You don't get that out of him. But Netflix is really letting him shine. And I liked Flanagan as a director with Hush and the other movies I saw, but Hill House is where I really grew to love and just not just think of him as like, oh, he's a good filmmaker. He is a phenomenal writer, director. He does it all. He edits most of his stuff. Like, he is a very, very, very talented dude, and he's found two homes. And I hope Dr. Sleep does well, because I would love a Flanagan studio movie where they let him play and do what he wants to do. I can't talk about how much I respect him as a creator, because he's taking the chances he gets and he's making the absolute most of it. For somebody who has come such a long way since 2013, and then this was 2016. So we're only talking 3 years to be this impactful on to have that many studio movies and that much Netflix content. He's spitting out content like crazy, and it's really good quality.
To go from a guy who is essentially on the roster at Blumhouse to a dude that's making some of the best horror content out there, it has been sort of a meteoric rise for a guy that's been putting in the time.
Yeah, and it's
weird to say.
And not to shit on him or anything, but it's a break from the Wanaverse. He's giving good horror movies that aren't connected to this Wanaverse, you know? And we're getting so many of those that it's a nice, refreshing break to get really good horror, even through the studio system.
To bring Juan into the discussion, one of the things that we liked about him when he was a young filmmaker was the fact that he was able to do stuff that was different. He was able to take a stripped down movie and still be able to scare the shit out of you and still be able to write it well. And that showed that he was a really capable horror filmmaker, and then he was given the opportunity to build a larger universe. Flanagan, I think if he wants to, he could certainly follow that path. I think he could do everything that Juan does just as well.
He did most of it in Hill House. Yeah. I mean, that movie, that show, if you have not watched Haunting on Hill House, it is so good. Because when you can throw in emotions to horror movies, I think that's when it becomes so much more impactful.
Other than just straight up fear.
Yeah, and you throw this family in and you mix it together. It's just so good. Like, it makes me want to go binge Hill House right now, just talking about it. Bent Neck Lady episode. When I watched that episode, I was in tears. I was like, losing it harder than I usually cry at stuff, and I cry at a lot of stuff. Raising Dion finale had me crying last week, but after Bent Neck Lady, like, I'm losing it. And I went to hit play now, and Talia, she would have been 7 at the time, grabs my arm and says, do you need a minute before the next one? like that's how wrecked I was. And it's just so good.
Yeah, so when you finish The Bent Neck Lady, when you finish the first season of Hill House, check out Hush 2. It's outstanding. There's a lot of Flanagan stuff you can find on Netflix, Gerald's Game. Like we said at the top, he does a lot of stuff for Netflix.
I can't mention Gerald's Game right here without just cringing. Like,
yeah.
That's what I mean about the gore is impactful. It's not gore for gore's sake. It's gore to really drive it home.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever listened to this show and wondered, if you're not familiar with Flanagan, why we keep talking about this guy as much as we do for somebody that, oh, I've never heard of him. I think Hush is a really good starter. Some people don't like horror movies per se, or you don't like a slasher movie.
It's not a ghost story. It's not a monster movie. Uh-uh. It's a home invasion survival movie.
Right. It's a well-made suspense movie. I mean, it's as close to Hitchcock as we get. And you know that I don't give a much higher compliment, or I cannot give a much higher compliment than that. And I would give that freely to Mike Flanagan. Another director that is starting to kind of make her way up the ladder a little bit.
She's already been pretty high on my list for a while as an actress.
Exactly. Is Elizabeth Banks. Been working for a long, long time in some variety of genres. She's kind of a bit of a chameleon there, and she is directing the Charlie's Angels. It's not a reboot. It's a sequel.
Continuation.
Yeah. Continuation of the...
installment.
Yes, the next installment of the Charlie's Angels films that were started years ago.
I am not ashamed to admit.
By the McG.
Looks amazing. I'm so amped for this movie. Kristen Stewart, the girl from Power Rangers, like, I am so on board for this movie. Every trailer looks great. I unabashedly, I don't know if that's the right word, I am not ashamed to say I cannot wait for Charlie's Angels.
To show you just how amped Dave is, we're going to do our favorite Elizabeth Banks movies next week, which could be Elizabeth Banks acting roles. It could be Elizabeth Banks directing, although she ends up being...
I don't think she's directed anything she hasn't been in yet.
Yeah, that's true. It'll be a fun list to dive into. She's one that I really, really like. I think the movies I like of her, I like an awful lot. And I have a feeling there's even more than I am currently thinking of right now. So that'll be a fun list to put together. I think a lot of these actor lists do end up being fun, especially if it's not somebody that there's such a weight, like, oh, favorite Tom Hanks movies, whatever. Now, Elizabeth Banks, her stuff's a lot of fun, so it should be a lot of fun to do that next week. So to find out how many movies she directed and did not star in, if we can find one, find out how many there are, come back next week. But until then, keep it up.